Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Welcome. Today I'm going to speak, I titled this lecture, Learn the Lyrics to God's Favorite Song. Wouldn't you want to know the lyrics to God's favorite song? Well, I'm going to teach you a few of them today. I couldn't possibly cover them all. It's a very long song. What is the Sanskrit word for song?
Gita.
Gita. Song. And what's the Sanskrit word for God? Bhagavan. God song. Song of God. There it is. Now, that is a vast book, my friends, and we don't have vast amounts of time. So we're just going to slim it down a bit. In the second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, there are 18 chapters. In Sanskrit, each chapter has a title, Sanskrit title. And the second chapter is actually entitled Sankhya Yoga. Prabhupada entitles the sixth chapter Sankhya Yoga. That's fine. But in this case, this applies to what we're talking about here. Sankhya is a term that means discretion or discrimination. The ability to use your brain to sort things out, to get to the truth. If you don't have any power of discernment, you're in trouble. Discernment or intellectual discretion is extremely important. Otherwise, how will you cross the street safely without it? But Sankhya also has, it has about 22 meanings, as I've said numerous times. The average Sanskrit word has about 22 meanings. And Sankhya is one of those words. So Sankhya also means something that is summarized or paraphrased. Second chapter. It's a summary. Prabhupada calls it contents of the Gita. Summarized. That's exactly what it is. So, as we know, this is a conversation between Krishna and Arjuna. Arjuna is a prince, warrior prince. Warrior means not that he's busy waging war on everybody, quite the opposite. It means that his job is to protect the people. That's the job of a kshatriya, a warrior, a governor, somebody in charge of things on behalf of the people in a kingdom, in a city, in a country, you name it. He's to look after everybody. That's his job, his duty. More important than his job, his duty. So, I'm not going to get into the whole history of that today, but we're on the battlefield at the verge of a huge battle. And Arjuna is, with his other four brothers, the Pandavas, is placed against his opponents are his relatives. Another part of the family, the Kauravas, as they're called, which include his grandfather and his teacher, who taught him the art of governance and war. So he's having conflicted feelings about going out and fighting against and many, many other people that he knew and that he was related to. So, like any human, he was having mixed feelings about fighting against all these people. And so he presents to Krishna. Krishna is God. Krishna was here 5,000 years ago. Krishna said Arjuna and Krishna were actually first cousins. And Krishna himself would not participate in the battle. Now, some knew that Krishna was God, and many did not know that he was God, and some wouldn't believe it anyway. You know, that's how that goes when God shows up. But God, Krishna said, no, I won't fight. I won't participate in the battle. I won't take sides. He says, but what I will do is, because of our friendship and our closeness, I'll drive your chariot for you. And Krishna had his own armies, had his own kingdom, but he gave all those to the opposing side, to Duryodhana. He gave all the armies, and Duryodhana said, whoa, I got all these men and soldiers, and boy, I got the best end of the deal. And Arjuna said, no, I got Krishna. I got God driving my chariot. So, anyway, Arjuna said, look, I can't fight. No, can't do it. It's not right. It's not moral. Even if I win, I won't be happy. He went on. Krishna says, in the first verse I'm looking at here, this is all in the second chapter, Ashochyan amashochas tvam pragya vadangs chabas shase gatasang agatasangs cha nanushochanti bandita. And Krishna said, while speaking learned words, you are mourning for what is not worthy of grief. Those who are wise lament neither for the living nor the dead. So he says, while speaking learned words, because Arjuna was putting forth all of these arguments, why not to fight? Because I'll be killing my kinsmen, and if they're gone, I won't be happy, even if I win a kingdom. I can't see any way out of this. In fact, he actually suggested that he go to the forest and meditate and renounce his duty as a governor, as a prince, as a warrior, just renounce it all. Just go meditate. Take the easy way out. So he says, you're speaking as though you know things, but you're mourning for what is not worthy of grief. So the first principle Krishna is about to explain is the difference between what? Matter and spirit. He says, the panditas, the wise, lament neither for the living nor the dead. If someone close to you dies, someone important in your life, we lament. We feel sorrow. Sometimes it's very tragic for different people. We understand that. But what we don't realize is that, well, we do and we don't. Everybody knows that death accompanies life on this plane. Ultimately, everything ends in death and loss. But we don't actually believe it, do we? We believe it, but we don't believe it. It might happen to the next guy. Not happen to me. Until it happens. How could that happen to me? How could my loved one be taken from me? So, when somebody dies, what is it? It's just the soul changing bodies. The body comes to an end. So that's the first point he makes. So then in the very next verse, Krishna says, never was there a time when I did not exist, nor you, nor all these kings. Because on the battlefield were arrayed many kings and leaders and rulers from many kingdoms. These are very powerful men. These weren't just a bunch of guys. They had a bunch of guys too. They had soldiers and warriors and whatever. But there was full of kings. So, never was there a time when you and I did not exist, nor all these kings, nor in the future shall any of us cease to be. There is no death. That's what he just said. It's no death. Now, in Vedic philosophy, primarily, Indian philosophy, there are two divisions, primarily, of God realization. One is monism. And the other is dualism. So one is that everything is one, God is one, we're all one. It's one. It's one and the same energy. Is that true? Yeah. It's true. And the other one is dualism. There's you and there's God. Two distinct personalities or beings. Is that true? Yeah, it's true. Both are true. But there's oftentimes many arguments and debate going on between the two parties as to what's the real truth. God is not separate. I'm God, you're God, we're all God. This is the monist or the Mayavad philosophy, understanding. So, in the Bhagavatam, it's pointed out, it says, Vedanti tattva vidas tattvam yajjnanam advayam brahmeti paramatmeti bhagavan iti shabdite. So there's actually three levels of God realization. Brahman, brahmeti, paramatma, paramatma, super soul within the heart, and Bhagavan, Bhagavan, Bhagavad, Bhagavan, God as a person. So the first level, Brahman, is energy. The next level, paramatma, is diversity. And the third level, Bhagavan, is personality. So on which level could one theoretically realize God? On any of the levels. Any of them. Or all. So Prabhupada has explained in many places that Mayavadis who think that all is one, which it is, Brahman is spirit. Spirit pervades everything. They believe that we are all God, we are all part of God. Well, we are part of God. And we would say here, because we are dualists or Dvaitists, we say no. Yes, we're part of God, but we're not of the same measure. And the examples that are given, commonly, Prabhupada has given them, is if you take a drop of ocean water and you analyze it, it has all the properties of ocean water, which is essentially hydrogen and sodium, right? So, but it has all those properties, but in a minute amount, whereas the ocean has the properties in a complete, full amount. So we have God-like qualities, we are parts of God, but we don't have the degree of it that God does. A simple explanation would be, if you were God, as you sit here, this moment, you'd have consciousness of everybody's body, everybody's mind. You'd know what everybody is thinking at this moment in time. By definition, you have consciousnesses of everything. But I'm going to guess that you don't. Unless maybe there's one or two of you here that do, that I don't know. In which case, please forgive me. But most of us do not. You have consciousness of your own body, your own mind, your own being. Another example is the fire. If God is a fire, then we are the sparks in that fire. Sparks, as you see sparks jumping up out of the flames of the fire, they're burning. If one lands on your arm, it hurts. So it's the same nature as the fire. But we can take those analogies a step further and say, what happens when a spark removes itself from the fire, falls upon the floor, it goes out. And it's no longer a spark. Well, how does that analogy work? What happens if you separate yourself from God for too long. You go out. You fizzle out. That's what happens. So, in order to stay in the fire, or to experience the spiritual nature, one must remain, or seek to remain, close to the source. No, close to God. Let's take the drop of water. A drop of water, let's say where the ocean water is smashing upon the rocks, as it does here, very nicely, out in the west of Ireland. And then a couple of drops land on a rock, and before long, what happens to those drops? They
dry up.
They dry up. They disappear. Because they lost their connection, no? So what are we doing here? Sitting down. We're trying to reestablish, or in some cases maintain, that connection. So here, in this verse, there was never a time when I did not exist, nor you, nor all these kings. What's he saying? You're eternal. You, yourself, as an individual, you're eternal. And you can say, well, am I eternal as Philip? Am I eternal as Terry? You know, am I eternal as Rita? Not exactly. You've taken a temporary identity. Well, why on earth would you choose a temporary identity? That doesn't seem like a good choice. Because you forgot your real one. You know? You go into the bakery or down here in Govinda's and you say, oh, I want this, this, and that. Oh, I want this aubergine Balaram. Oh, we're out of that. Oh. Okay. Well, what's your second choice? This is it. This is the second choice. Right there. Because you forgot about the first choice. You weren't out of it. You just forgot to ask for it. That's the reality here. We forgot. So Brahman is spirit. And that's where people merge with God. I'm God, you're God, we're all one, it's all the same. And that's typically what the jnanis, what the mental speculators, those who follow such a path in yoga, jnana yoga, that's what they strive for. But there's no diversity. There's nothing interesting. It gets boring. You're just part of this energy. The yogis strive for Paramatma realization. And if Paramatma realization is diversity, what does it mean? It means to be able to see within each person. Look at us all here. Look how diverse we are. We're all so different. What do we have in common? Oh, we're human. Yeah, okay, I'll give you that. But what do we have in common is that God is inside of our hearts, each one of us. When we don't see God, when we don't appreciate, when we don't sense or understand that God is actually in the heart of this other person I'm speaking to, then we begin to do what? We begin to discriminate against them. There's me and there's him. I better win. I don't care if he loses. I'm going to look after myself. Never mind them. That's what we do. Right? That's typically what we do. So, appreciating that everybody has God in their heart leads to a whole different mindset and behavior, doesn't it? That's when we develop compassion and love. Here we practice bhakti yoga, the yoga of compassion and love. That's the concept here. But the highest level of God realization is Bhagavan. God, the personality. Because interacting with a personality, if you want to have a relationship with somebody, I don't care who or what it is, it's very difficult to have a relationship unless there's a subject and an object. You can say, I have a relationship with God and God's energy. Yeah, Okay, theoretically you do. But if God was sitting there, if you have a vision of God as a personality and you learn all about him and what he's like and what he likes and so many things, your ability to have that relationship will become far more dynamic. So that's the highest level of God realization. You can say, oh, I don't want that level. Okay, fine. There's two other levels available. But that's what we're focused on here. And in this verse, Krishna says, oh, don't worry, your individuality is assured. You're not going to merge and we're going to lose track of you like a drop of water in the ocean. Don't worry. Then he says, as the embodied soul continually passes in this body from boyhood to youth to old age, the soul similarly passes into another body at death. The self-realized soul is not bewildered by such a change. Well, we call this reincarnation, simply. The reason people suffer to such a degree as they do in this world, so much of that suffering and anxiety could be dismissed that quickly by understanding two principles only. Only two. Karma and reincarnation. Okay, just understanding karma and reincarnation, a lot of the anxiety would go away. There is no death. I lost my loved one. That's okay. Your loved one moved on to another situation according to the karma. Unless your realized soul, in which case we've exhausted the karma and we move on to the spiritual realm. We don't need another birth down here. Right? That's when we actually recover or regain our true identity. This is who I am. Like at night you dream, you could dream all kinds of crazy things. I'm sure you do. And in the morning you wake up, oh, God, I was dead. And you tell, you know, somebody your dream, and you, oh, thank God I woke up from that one. This is me. Yeah, well, this is a dream too. This is a dream too. So, this example Krishna gives is to show that the body is actually changeable here in front of our eyes. If we saw a photograph of you at 2 years old, dare I say you'd look far different than you do now. We may not even recognize you. We may not. And we see a photograph of you at 65 or 70 years old, you're going to be a lot different, aren't you? So that proves that the body actually goes through physical changes. Yeah, you know, some things are the same. Some people don't look the same at all. You'd never recognize them. Others, perhaps. But the point is, the body goes through various phases. Boyhood, youth, old age, and then, you know, finally death. And you know when somebody's dead. How do we all know? When we haven't been trained, how do we all know when somebody's dead?
They're cold.
They're cold. Okay, that'll work. They have no consciousness. They're not there. They've gone. Simple. You can nudge them. Wake up. Wake up. Nothing happens. All right? So, because you see that the body passes through different phases while alive, you should understand that the soul just changes bodies after death. A self-realized soul is not bewildered by such a change. A self-realized soul does not lament when somebody dies. Yes, there may be loss and sorrow. There are many cultures where there's actually a celebration when somebody dies because they're going on to, theoretically, something better. Then he says, one of my favorites, Matra Sparshas Tukanteya Shitoshna Sukha Dukkada Agama Paino Nityas Tongs Titikshas Vabharata. So he says here that the non-permanent appearance of happiness and distress, still Krishna talking, and their disappearance in due course. Happiness comes, it goes. How do we say it? We say it every day. Oh, what a day. Ever said that? This isn't my day, let me tell you. Huh? I shouldn't have gotten out of bed today. I should have stayed home. Or, boy, this is my day. Everything's working. Or I met this person, I met that person, I got the job offer, whatever. I was able to come to the temple, meet Krishna Prasad. It's my day. So, happiness and distress is a non-permanent appearance and disappearance. It comes for whom? Just a couple people? Everyone, my friends. We are all in this together. We are all in this together. So, we have ups and downs. Good days, bad days. Right? And he says, this is just like what? The appearance of the winter and summer seasons. It's a great analogy. Right? It actually works for both India as an example and Ireland as another example, or the East and the West, because they have different concepts of what winter and summer might feel like. Here, we love the summer. The Irish are always wondering where it is, but why didn't it come this year? Why did it only come on a Thursday? But we love the summer here, don't we? We love the warm weather. We love the sunshine. It's not as freely given as in other places. Winter, we're not so keen on winter. It gets colder and a lot more rain, and sometimes, rarely, but snow on occasion. India is just the opposite. It's the summer that becomes very, very oppressive, because the heat gets crazy. I was in India once. It was 47 degrees. You know, you get in, you stay in by 9 a.m. You're in. That's it for the day. I mean, you know, you can come out late at night maybe. So it doesn't matter. Winter and summer seasons deliver happiness, distress. That is the point. They arise from sense perception only. Only because we have senses and we're engaging with our environment. That's all. And one should learn to tolerate them. Titikshasva means tolerate. Please tolerate. And don't be disturbed. So he's saying that about what? He's saying that about life and death as well. You must learn to tolerate. In this world, these things are inevitable. Oh, now he's telling you, he's giving you the first key to open the door. He's throwing you one here. He's giving you the truth or the way out. You can say, well, you know, I'm tired of all this. I'm tired of losing my loved ones. I'm tired of my child having a serious disease. I'm tired of losing the people that were closest to me. I'm tired of losing all my money when the financial crash comes. I'm tired of working at this job. I hate my boss. How do we get out of here? And Krishna says, the person who is not disturbed by happiness and distress and who is steady in both. Steady mind, no matter what happens. That person is certainly eligible for liberation. Really? Is it that easy? My words, not his. I mean, his words, not mine. My mistake, not his. Steady in happiness and distress is eligible for liberation. Liberation from what? From all your sorrow, from your worry, from your fear, from your loss, from your suffering. Well, where do I go? Desert island? In the Pacific? No, not exactly. You get off the wheel of samsara, repeated birth and death. Samsara dhavana salida loka. The wheel of repeated birth and death is like being caught in a forest fire. That's what Vishwanath Chakravarti said. So that's what he means here by liberation. Now he tells you the nature of the soul. He starts telling Arjuna, let me explain the nature of the soul so you're clear on what the soul is and what its constitution is. He says, no, that which pervades the entire body is indestructible. No one is able to destroy the imperishable soul. You know what's real popular in our culture is this superhero business. And they got all kinds of them. They usually are characters in comic books, and now they're all over the movies and have been so for years. You know, this superhero or that superhero or whatever it is they do. They have the powers. But what would be the greatest power of them all if you were a superhero or heroine? To be what?
Immortal.
Indestructible. Immortal. You already are. You're already a superhero. Super heroine, here you are. And no one's recognizing it about you, are they? No one's come up to you and going, hey, I know you're a superhero. You got this power of being indestructible. When's the last time somebody said that to you? And what would you say if they did? Really? I didn't know that. I do? Are you sure? When did I get it? You've always had it. You forgot about it. You're indestructible. Do you act like you are? No, you don't. You act like you're destructible. You act like you're unworthy. You act like you're undeserving. You believe in death. Stop believing in death and become what you are, the soul, indestructible. No one is able to destroy the imperishable soul, Krishna said. No one can destroy the soul. They can drop a bomb on you, they can use guns, they can use poison, whatever. They can't kill you. You're indestructible. Now, if you would take a few minutes each day and just meditate on the fact that you are indestructible, that you are a soul, that you are a spirit, that you are eternal, that you are a part of God, I wonder what that would do for you in your life. Imagine what effect that might have. If you always thought about that or with some regularity, do you think that might change your outlook? So people say, well, you know, we're here, we're trying to become God conscious. Yes, on the one hand, that's true. But the thing about the soul that we oftentimes don't realize, it's fully conscious. It's not like we have to become something we're not. We are already fully God conscious. And you can say, no, I'm not. Yeah, you are. You are covered over by the modes of nature. You are covered over by a more dense consciousness or perception that makes you forget that you are indestructible and imperishable, and you already are conscious. The soul is divine, perfect, and complete in its own traditional constitutional position. But we're covered over, so now we believe all these false things about ourselves. Oh, I have heart problems. No, you don't. Yes, I do. Cardiologist told me I do. No, your body does. You don't. But I identify with it. But it's not you. For example. Now, the soul has complete consciousness, but it's covered over. Just like what? Let's take an example. A precious gem is inside a big rock formation. How do you know it's in there? Well, we don't know it's in there. But we're going to mine, and we're going to find out, because we think it's in there. And we start mining and blowing stuff up. You know what we do. We can never leave well enough alone, can we? And then we get this piece of rock, and we think, okay, now let me chip away at it. And there is a diamond. Doesn't look like a diamond, looks like a dirty old piece of rock. As they remove that dense rock, inside is a gem. They cut it out till you got the rough stone, and that is given to a gem cutter. You've seen what they do with gems? Gem cutter? They turn them into these beautiful, glistening, sparkling, brilliant, extremely valuable stones. It's not that they turn them into it, they bring them out. Right? Isn't it? It's already there, but he knows how to work with it. My wife is a gemologist. She studied at the Gemological Institute of America, which is a world-class body, and graduated in Los Angeles several years ago. We went there for that. And they had a gem cutter come. This is kind of a side story. They had a gem cutter come. This guy was like in his 70s. He had been cutting gems throughout his life. He's one of the top gem cutters in the world. And he said, they asked him, well, how do you know how to cut a stone properly, you know? Because if you make one wrong cut, you can ruin the stone. All it takes is one wrong slice. That stone is not worth what it would have been worth a second ago. That is a fact. And they look at it through, you know, the big glasses, the and/or microscope. You know, that's how they look at it. He says, I just sit there and I sit with the stone. And I wait. What do you wait for? So I wait for the stone to start talking to me. You what? I wait until it tells me what I need to do. Sometimes I sit for a couple days, 3 days, nothing happens. And people look at me and go, why aren't you working? But I am working. I'm listening. I'm listening to find the soul. I'm waiting for it to tell me where the soul is located. Then, and then only, he starts to cut. And this guy is one of the top gem cutters in the world. Listen to how he does it. It's not like you would think. It's he talks to the stone. Okay. So the same idea, we bring this the diamond out, it's the same thing with the soul. It's no different. So then Krishna says, only the material body of the indestructible, immeasurable, and eternal living entity is subject to destruction. Therefore, fight. He says, you should fight. Your duty here in this circumstance is to fight. Your kingdom has been stolen from you. It's been usurped. It's been taken unlawfully due to greed and envy. And your job is to fight and return the kingdom to its rightful owner and to the people who are most enlightened in terms of governing the citizens. So, he says, this is a very famous verse, "For the soul, there's never birth nor death, nor having once been, does he ever cease to be." He's unborn, eternal, ever-existing, undying, and primeval. He is not slain when the body is slain. So why does he use the verb slain, kill? Because we're at the verge of a battle. So even if somebody is slain in battle, he's not slain. It's also explained in the Vedas that those who die in battle, especially on religious principles, acting out of dharma, and they've sacrificed their lives on behalf of others, what happens to those souls? Where do they go? They go to the heavenly planets. That is the reward. To go to the heavenly worlds within the material world. When you sacrifice your life. When you try to save somebody. We've had a few stories recently of people jumping in the water trying to save people that are drowning. And they die. That's a hero's death, no? That soul goes to the heavenly planets. For example. So, primeval. He's not slain when the body is slain. So, Krishna is explaining the nature of the soul to Arjuna. What does primeval mean? Very old. And another meaning for it is the soul doesn't have a beginning. God has no beginning. Right? He's beginningless. So, same idea with the soul. What's the Einstein one? Matter cannot be created nor destroyed. It can be transformed. So that principle actually, it works in that manner. And then he says, I love this verse, as a person puts on new garments, giving up the old and useless ones. The soul accepts new material bodies, giving up the old and useless ones at death. Right? That's what happens. You give up a body. Why do you give up a body? Well, your time may have run out, but in most cases, you grow old and the body just wears out, doesn't it? Why is it that older people have a list of problems with the body? Well, then I had this, then that was fixed, then I had that, and they didn't know about that, and then I got that. How many times have we heard that? You know, not all of them, but many. So the body becomes worn out. It's useless. That's all. And you change bodies. According to what? Your nature, your desire, what you meditate on. It says in the 8th chapter that whatever you meditate on, at the point of death, that's what you get, or that's where you will go. That will determine your next body. So, if you're meditating on cars, or a person, or a kind of enjoyment that you prefer, or a family member, whatever, your dog. Whatever it might be, that's where you go. That's what you get. So it's really important, especially at the last moment, to meditate on God. if you want to get out of the material world and you want to live eternally free from distress. The soul cannot be cut into pieces by any weapon, nor can he be burned by fire, nor moistened by water, nor withered by the wind. You can't get me. I'm indestructible. So the point, Krishna, is don't grieve. Don't grieve for the body. Once somebody said to me, I didn't see you at that funeral. I said, well, I didn't go to that funeral. And she said, you have a problem with death, huh? Me? In what way? Well, you don't like to be around it. Maybe you're uncomfortable about it. No. I'd say probably the opposite. I didn't feel the need to do that. No, there's nothing wrong with going to funerals. This was about somebody that I didn't even know. Never actually met the person. But, death. What's the greatest fear?
Death.
Death. Is there something bigger than death that you're afraid of? Losing the lotto? Not winning the lotto? No, death. How many of you here genuinely are no longer or are not afraid of death? Have gotten past that? Let's say about 25%. How many are really, really honestly afraid of death? Yeah, about 25%. So there's 50% that, I guess, the undecideds, as they call them in politics. The undecideds. We want to swing them this way, or we're going to swing them that way. The swing vote, they call it. Okay. Don't be afraid of death. Somehow get to the point where you're not afraid. Now, if you're a serial murderer, if that's your thing, I don't think we have a lot of those here, then I would be very afraid of death. That would be my best advice. But then you already are, so because you know what's coming. No one escapes the karma, right? But if you're a good person, generally speaking, you do right by others. No need to be afraid. And here we try to learn to love God. That's what we do. That's the whole program here. Learn to love God. And by learning to love God, you will learn to love everything that is part of God, including the animals, including Mother Nature. There's no selective loving. Okay, I'll love white people, or I'll love dark people, or I'll love people but not animals. No. Or I'll love people and animals but I'll pollute Mother Nature. No. Then Krishna says, so Arjuna, do thou fight for the sake of fighting. Without considering happiness or distress, loss or gain, victory or defeat. And by so doing, you shall never incur sin. Whoa. That's a powerful statement. Well, wait a second now. Let me get this right, Krishna. I'm a warrior, and I'm not supposed to be attached to winning. Now, the first part he says, fight for the sake of fighting. What does that mean? He's a fighter. He's a warrior. He's a prince. He's a protector. That's his job. That's his dharma. Your dharma is your duty. It's your obligation. It's what you do. It's what people depend on you to do. And your dharma means you act in accordance with your nature, your God-given gifts. That's your dharma. Go do your dharma. Do your duty. That's all. That's all you got to do. Well, what kind of dharma? Anything could be your duty. You could fix cars. That could be your dharma. You could be a cosmetologist and do hair, beautician. That could be your dharma. You could be a doctor. You could be a accountant. You could be anything. Do your dharma. And what does it also mean? Doing your dharma means to act with virtue and honesty and truth. Means do the best job you can do. Doesn't matter what you do. You must do the best job. You owe that to yourself, and you owe that to everyone else. We go a step further and we say, offer it all to God. And offer it all to God. And he gets to that here. So, without considering victory or defeat, whatever you do, you have no control over the outcome. You try to do your best at your job, your dharma, whatever it is, but you can't control the result. You can try and control it and do the best that you can. You might do a job for the boss and then you hand it in. The boss goes, what is this? What am I going to do with this? This is not what I asked for. You have no control over that. For example, you might think that, well, that's not fair. I thought I did a really good job. Doesn't matter. So the point here is you can't control the outcome. That's why people are, you know, they go up and down emotionally. When the Irish rugby team wins the match, everybody celebrates. When they lose, they go into depression. Yeah, it's a joke. No, it's not a joke. People go into depression for a time. When I was 18, I was cheering on my football team. And they lost the big cup. They were in that game and they lost. And for the next 3 days, I couldn't figure out what the heck was wrong with me. And then I realized, you're depressed. Well, why am I depressed? Because your team lost the match. Well, that seems ridiculous. Yes, it is. So since that time, I don't care who wins. I just want to see a good match. Yeah, so people get depressed because they're attached. Don't be attached to the results. That's what Krishna is telling Arjun. And you'll never incur sin. What is sin? The karmic repercussion, right? The blowback. Everything, every action carries a reaction. If you're attached to the rugby team winning and the rugby team loses, there's a reaction. What's the reaction? Depression, despondency. Your heart sinks. Your mouth dries up. There's actually symptoms. So, he's tough. Don't be attached. Arjuna had the same symptoms. Dropped his bow. Dropped his quiver. My mouth is dried up. You know, I have no strength in my arms. He said all those things earlier. Be steadfast in yoga, O Arjun. Yogastha kuru karmani sangam tyaktva dhananjaya siddhya siddhyo samo bhutva samatvam yoga uchyate. Be steadfast in yoga, O Arjuna. Yoga means what? Linking with God. No, it's not like sweaty yoga, aerobic yoga. Huh?
Sauna yoga.
sauna yoga, steam bath yoga, pitch yoga, running around the pitch. No. Yoga means to link with God. That's what it means. So when you link with God, when you offer everything to God, and when you are not attached to the fruits of your labor, whatever happens, happens. That's yoga. And what happens to you then? Krishna says, perform your duty and abandon all attachment to success or failure. Such evenness of mind is called yoga. Now, admittedly, very few people can do it, my friends. But that's what we are encouraging you to learn, and that's what we are encouraging you to practice here. In the 18th chapter, going fast forward from chapter 2 to chapter 18, Krishna gives the ultimate verse. Well, what did he do in all the middle of this, all these pages? He explains all the systems of yoga, the various ways in which one can link with God. And it doesn't matter what level you're on, he's got a yoga practice for you. It's all there. But then, at the very end, or almost at the very end, you know what he says? Sarva dhanaman parityajya mame kam sharanam vraja aham tvam sarva papebhyo mukshayishyami ma shucha. Don't worry. Chill. He says, but you know, give up all this, all these dharmas, all these yoga practices, this, all these things I told you, forget about that. He just nullifies it all after he's explained it, but just now you at least you know where it all fits and how it works. Now forget all that. Sarva dharman, all these dharmas, parityajya. Tyajya means what?
Give up.
Renounce. Let go. Parityajya means what? Completely. In every possible way. From every viewpoint. Parityajya. Mame kam sharanam vraja. Vraja means go and sharanam. Surrender. Or take shelter of. Mam, me. This is God speaking. Ekam means only me, just me. Mam ekam sharanam vraja. Aham tvam sarva papebhyo mokshayishyami. I will free you. I will liberate you. I will deliver you from all your sarva papa, from all of your negative karmic reaction, from all this stuff that you've been engaged in for how many lifetimes, all these difficulties, all these repeated births, repeated deaths. I will personally take charge. I promise I will take care of you if you surrender to me, if you come to me. I will not turn you away. I will not let you down. Mashajah, don't worry, nothing to fear. That's what he says. So can we go from 0 to 60 in a few seconds, yoga wise? No, it's going to take time because we are so conditioned. Day in and day out, we are conditioned by material life and our limited belief systems. Our education, our family, our culture, our country, so many things. Our opinions of our family, our spouse, so many things. We are conditioned, meaning limited. Caught in a box. It's very difficult to get out. You know that. What have you ever tried to get out of in your life? Sometimes you have want to get away, get out. Is it easy? Not usually. Sometimes it takes a superhuman effort. Sometimes we don't get out. So, we want to get out. We want to get past all this material conditioning and stop round and round on this wheel of reincarnation. So Krishna is saying, come to me. I'll look after you. And of course, that's the last verse of the song. Not the very last verse in the book. But that's the message that God's favorite song is delivering. The lyrics are all in Sanskrit. Sanskrit is not just a language. Yeah, it's another language. Different one. No. Sanskrit is divine sound vibration. It's not like any other language because it transforms. Just you sit around and chant Sanskrit verses. They're all transliterated here. And see how that goes. That's why we chant the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra. Sanskrit. It's transcendental. It's a transcendental sound vibration. In this case, it's Krishna's names, the names of God. But Sanskrit is transcendental language. And it carries that energy with it. Okay. Thank you for your kind attention. And we're going to be having another kirtan and Krishna Prasad. As we chant, we cleanse the mirror of the mind from all of this negative conditioning that we've taken on for how many lifetimes. That's what the chanting is for. It's a purifying process. That's what eating food that has been offered to God also does. Oh, it can't be that simple. It cannot be that easy. It can be. A child can chant the mantra. Anybody can. Okay. Any questions? Good. I must have covered it. Thank you. Hare Krishna.